I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, January 6th. One way to look at the events of last January 6th is that the violent break-in at the Capitol has been the focus of too much attention for the past year, because the bigger crime was the attempt by Trump and his allies in Congress to block certification of the election through the peaceful political process. As it happens, former Trump trade advisor Peter Navarro, a member of Trump's inner circle on January 6th, has a new book called Trump Time that, with no apparent shame, describes what they were trying to do and basically says they would have gotten away with it were it not for the rioters discrediting their moment. Here is Peter Navarro on MSNBC this week describing the plan that they actually had a name for, the Green Bay Sweep.
The plan was simply this. We had over 100 congressmen and senators on Capitol Hill ready to implement the sweep. The sweep was simply that. We were going to challenge the results of the election in the six battleground states. They were Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, Nevada. And basically, these were the places where we believed that if the votes were sent back to those battleground states and looked at again, that there would be enough concern amongst the legislatures that most or all of those states would decertify the election. That would throw the election to the House of Representatives. And I would say to you here, Ari, that all of this, again, it was in the lanes legally. It was prescribed by the Constitution. There is a provision to go, rather than through the Electoral College, to the House of Representatives. And all this required was peace and calm on Capitol Hill. And at 1 p.m., Senator Ted Cruz and Gosart, a representative, started the Green Bay sweep beautifully, challenging the results of Arizona.
So that's Peter Navarro, not the best known Trump ally, but one of the most important, on January 6th, speaking with Ari Melber on MSNBC on Tuesday night, as they've been saying the quiet part out loud. With me now, Amanda Carpenter, political columnist for The Bulwark, a news and opinion site founded by conservatives who did not support Donald Trump. Carpenter is also a CNN political commentator and was previously communications director for Senator Ted Cruz. Her most recent article on The Bulwark site is called, sarcastically, The Good Coup. In other recent articles, she describes the Republican Party today as a war of all against all and gives her take on why the progressive protests against Joe Manchin have so far backfired. Amanda, thanks so much for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
Your article is called The Good Coup. Peter Navarro denies that it would have been a coup at all. Why do you use that word?
Well, number one, I want to thank you for getting the sarcasm in that title, because some people have not. But
it's pretty clear when you read the text.
Correct. It is stunning that Peter Navarro is laying out the plan. But the reason he is so confident in doing so is because he's right. There was a legal process to do this. Of course, the process was predicated on conspiracies and lies, but that doesn't mean Republicans couldn't have gotten away with it. Had Mike Pence acted to delay or throw this back to the states, there was a decent chance, and he specifically talks about states such as Arizona and Nevada and Georgia, that had Republican-controlled legislatures who would have been willing to decertify that election. And we know this continued to play out in Arizona, for example, where there was a many months long campaign to audit those elections to no end. There were pressure campaigns at the homes of Republican governor in Georgia, Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. And so this was very elaborate. It was planned out. And we don't know what would have happened had that gone forward.
So were Navarro and Trump and Bannon, I guess the big three leaders of this plan, simply hoping partisanship would carry the day for Republican legislatures, where the Republican secretaries of state and governors, as you were just describing, had done their job professionally?
Absolutely. I mean, there is a process to ultimately throw the election to a vote in the House of Representatives. It's a majority vote, but it's not just based on members. It's by state delegations. And in that scenario, there is a very likely chance that they would have given it to Trump. And you can see that from the vote after the Capitol was breached. Everyone saw what happened, and still 127 Republican members opposed certifying Biden as president.
Navarro seems to believe that were it not for what your article calls those meddling insurrectionists, there's a Scooby-Doo reference in there somewhere, I guess, were it not for the violent break-in by the pro-Trump mob, they would have gotten away with it. Do you think they would have had the votes in Congress that day, or that Mike Pence would have played the role that he would have had to have played?
It's hard to say. It's unlike, given what Mike Pence did that day, it is clear from all the reporting that Mike Pence was not on board with this plan. But it is also clear from the reporting that this entire pressure campaign in the final days was decided to come down on Mike Pence because they knew he was the weak link. And so had he gone the other way, we can't say for sure. Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, you know, right now the most powerful Republican in Washington, is kind of dismissing all of this, saying, well, you really think if it would have gone to the state legislatures would have decertified Biden as president? And I think that is an open question. He dismisses it. And I think it's an open question because what we've seen in the state legislatures to restrict the right to vote based on Trump's election lies over the past year.
You write that the Navarro book and interviews show how closely he and Trump coordinated January 6th with members of Congress. What's new there for you?
The new part in what he is saying is that he compiled these reports. I believe it's called the Immaculate Deception, which essentially was his case arguing how the election was stolen. He presented it to Trump by his own account. And by Navarro's own account, he says that Trump wanted it distributed to all House and Senate offices. And ultimately, it was distributed to at least 100 members. And Navarro says that Steve Bannon acted as the whip for this event. And Steve Bannon had 100 members on board with this plan to object to the election results by objecting to the Electoral College votes based on the reports that Navarro compiled.
But that some of them shrunk from playing that role to the fullest, you know, possible extent because they were chilled by the riot?
Well, not only chilled, their actions were blocked by the riot. As Navarro says, everything was going according to his plan when Ted Cruz started to object to the counts, I believe, in Pennsylvania. But at that point, the mob had breached the Capitol, and those proceedings were brought to a halt. Mm.
And I know you were previously Ted Cruz's communications director. I don't know your relationship with him now, but Cruz was cited by Navarro in that clip there, and you just repeated it, as launching this process that he called the Green Bay Sweep at 1 o'clock that day before violence interrupted the session. And Cruz, I believe, has never shown any regret for the role he was trying to play that day. So how do you understand your old boss and how much he really believes in all this fraud with no evidence of fraud versus how much he's just been gaslighting the public for political gain?
Let's see. So just so your listeners are aware, I worked as his communications director until July of 2015. The actions he's taken now, I do not recognize. But my read of this is that he is a competitive lawyer, confident in his abilities. And he had the chance to present a case that would endear him to President Trump that could potentially lay the foundation for his next presidential run, perhaps, and decided to take that case. And he made it on January 6th, and he'll be forever remembered for it in good ways by Trump's followers, in bad ways by, I think, history. And to this day, it appears that he's taken the route that a lot of Republicans have taken in trying to just lay responsibility for January 6th on the people who breached the Capitol, who fought with Capitol Police and others, but not the people who summoned the mob to the Capitol that day. And that's the real disconnect.
And with Amanda Carpenter from The Bulwark, Manuel in North Bergen, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes. I want to say a couple of things about this. The people right now that's coming out saying there was a legal way of stopping the election of Biden and actually Harris. Giving it to eventually, it's more dangerous than the people who assaulted the Capitol. And hello, are you there?
Yeah, we're listening.
Yes, this is number one. And number two, I happen to be from Spain, and we lived under dictatorships in the 20th century twice. And I know what it means. And in Spanish, it's called, when you overthrow the government, elected legitimately, it's called a golpe de Estado. Instead of calling it coup d'etat, let's call it golpe de Estado. And most people in this country are not familiar with this, the terrible thing of these actions, what consequences. And number three, let's call these people what they are. They're fascists. Okay? I think it's important, the language we use. And I disagree completely with the reporter. They're saying there was a legal way of keeping Trump in power. And with that, I'm very emotional, and I cannot actually continue because I think it's very dangerous. I've been in this country 60 years, but my family has been here like 100 years. And I have grandchildren, and I feel very bad for the future of this country if you let the fascists continue and justify these actions. Thank you.
Manuel, thank you so much. And I think that's a really chilling reminder from somebody whose family had experience in a country where there was a democracy and then there wasn't a democracy, what this looks like, what this reminds him of. And that if it were to proceed much further, fascism really would not be an inappropriate term. Amanda, do you disagree?
No, I'm just reflecting on what he said. And, you know, stories like the life lived by someone like that caller, you know, the Republican Party used to want to elevate those stories and tell them as a example of why America is special and exceptional and important. And that needs to remain true. And I want to clarify that when I talk about how there was a legal process that Republicans could have used to flip the election, I don't mean to endorse that process or say it was just, because it was not. But I do think people need to be aware that these processes do exist by bad actors who are willing to exploit them. And I absolutely agree with the caller that I am more worried about the so-called, you know, let's call them insurrectionists in suits rather than the ones in sweatpants, because the guys in sweatpants and fatigues are in jail right now. The men and women wearing suits and standing in the halls of Congress who effectively wanted to go down the same path have faced no consequences whatsoever.
So why do you think most Republicans, including 88% of Trump voters in the recent Washington Post poll, believe the big lie? Nobody's ever shown any compelling evidence of widespread election fraud. Trump's otherwise loyal Attorney General, William Barr, said that, and the courts were never presented with such evidence and more than 60 court challenges to the election before Biden was sworn in. There are some, and I would say I think, you know, more people of color in this country than white people think, hey, look, this is, you know, part of what America's always been. Trump's just running to the head of the parade. What would you say about the idea that the rot is really in Republican America, not in Donald Trump or in Donald Trump, but that Donald Trump is just a reflection of the rot in Republican America?
Well, I think we should start with the fact for this particular part of the conversation, sort of take the Republican people who have an R behind their name professionally out of it. And let's talk about the typical Republican voter. If you are a person who supported Donald Trump twice, generally liked what he has done for America, and also live in this sort of cultural soup where you are told that conservatives are always discriminated against, whether in the media, academia, the courts, etc. And then the president you supported twice primes you for the possibility of elections being rigged against him, and then tells you over and over and over and over and over that it was, you're probably going to believe him. You're probably going to believe the president of the United States. And he has not once let off from that narrative. It got spun up by a lot of other Republican leaders through those Georgia Senate races, which I believe served as a critical staging ground for the big election lie. And you put that together with a pandemic that was happening. And there were things happening in the states, which I supported, to expand the right to vote in a pandemic, because we wanted to make sure that no one would lose the ability to vote because of COVID. There's a lot of mistrust that was exploited. And Donald Trump is a master manipulator, and he's manipulated millions of people into believing this big election lie.
So last question for today, Amanda. The Democrats are using this January 6th anniversary in part to publicize their push for voting rights legislation in Congress following the attempt to overturn people's votes. And I'm curious how you see the shift in your party on this issue, because as recently as 2006, as I'm sure you know, the Senate voted 98-0 to renew the Voting Rights Act with its requirement for preclearance of any voting law changes in states and localities that had histories of voting rights violations. It was a lot of southern states. It was New York City. A lot of people don't know that. But the Supreme Court in 2013 threw out the old version of that requirement. But Congress could revise it and renew it with the current John Lewis voting rights bill, the Democrats say. So how did the GOP go from zero votes against the Voting Rights Act to zero votes to support it, except for Lisa Murkowski?
Well, not only that, but the sudden, you know, new opposition to mail-in voting, which is traditionally something that has benefited the Republican Party, who needs to reach voters who are in rural areas, who might not be able to appear in person on election day. But somehow the bias in the party has completely changed to only wanting people to appear in person, in line, at the polls on election day. And this is largely just because of how Donald Trump chose to attack the voting process in the 2020 election. And so it's really interesting to me because I happen to live in West Virginia. Joe Manchin has presented a voting rights bill, which is the compromise between, I guess, the moderates and the progressives in his party. And it's modeled on a lot of West Virginia law that has traditionally been supported and enforced successfully by Republicans. And so we'll see where this goes. But it is incredible to me just tactically that we saw such a sustained attack on voting and democracy. It wasn't just on January 6th. It was the whole, starting the summer of 2020, all the way through January 6th. And the Democrats have been unable to make any reforms possible on a federal level.
Amanda Carpenter, political columnist for The Bulwark. Thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.